administrative services and available to help me out when I need it. So with that, I think I'll start. It might be helpful if you know that I'm going to work off of the PowerPoint handout that you were given. I'm going to kind of walk through that. And hopefully it will coincide with everything else you have, but it's sort of our approach to looking at the information. And basically, we're going to walk through kind of the fundamentals of our offices and then maybe a little bit about our funding historically, what our priorities are. We want to talk to you about the governor's recommended budget and then our policy packages, some performance measures, and then some legislation that is affecting our budget. So the mission statement is really very, very straightforward. You should have it in front of you. It isn't any surprises. It's to uphold the U.S. and Oregon constitutions and preserve the safety of the public. Our functions and responsibilities really are statutory, and some of them are listed on the PowerPoint that you have, prosecution of crime being the primary one, but including things such as grand jury functions and child support enforcement, juvenile proceedings, and in some cases, I think we have 9 counties where the DAs operate as a county council as well, typically the smaller counties. Most counties started out that way. In addition, on the next PowerPoint on page 4 are a whole list of responsibilities that are more specific that fall under those statutes. As you can see from them, our responsibilities are wide. Anything from handling public records requests, which can be at times very controversial, to providing legal advice to law enforcement, to providing victims services, which has become a more and more important function for our offices. And again, the list is quite wide, and there for your review. Our priorities, obviously, are public safety, beginning with prosecution of crime, services to victims and families. We partner a great deal with law enforcement in just about every imaginable way, both formally and informally. And then one of the roles, particularly of community of elected DAs, but also of deputy DAs, is community outreach. Some of our offices, such as mine, have community prosecutors. And we think one of our jobs is to help the public understand what our jobs are and what our roles are. On slide number 6, this is really just an explanation of historically, in the big picture, how funding has worked for DAs. In 1971, there was an agreement for the state and the counties to share. There was never really an agreement as to percentages. And quite frankly, since then, the partnership between the state and the counties has changed quite dramatically, with almost all the funding, as you heard, going to being the responsibility of the counties now. What we're asking really is to be treated proportionate to other public safety agencies, which has not happened in the last number of sessions. And that's what slide number 7 shows you. Slide number 8 is really, I think, something a little more of substance. I heard staff mention that today the funding for state funding for DAs overall is about 10%, and actually we think it's closer to 5%. 5.2%. Those numbers aren't that different, but it gives you an example, kind of a picture of what's happened. If you look back in 1974, it was about 19%. 19% state, 81% county. It's now 5% state, 95% county. So, yes, Chair.
I could ask you a question. And it's my understanding that salaries for the DAs themselves have been flat for how long?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, I wouldn't say they've been flat. I've been a district attorney for 6.5 years. This time I was DA once before. My salary has changed since both times. So over about 12 years, my salary has improved.
The state contribution?
Yes, it has. It was the last session. Actually, it's happened twice. Between 1995 and 2001, the state increased state salaries, I believe. And then in 2005, and staff can correct me if I get this wrong, 2005, half of the DAs, approximately half, received another pay raise. And this was all to try and keep up with the our peers in other states.
So, but it's been flat from 01 to 05.
Except for half the DAs received a pay increase, I think, in 2005-07.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mr. Chair, I think it's important to note that many counties also contribute to the DA salaries themselves.
Yes.
I'm not sure in Mr. Foote's case, but many counties, if not most of the counties, do contribute some amount of compensation and in some cases other benefits to the DAs themselves.
Chair Shields, that is correct. I am very grateful for my county being one of those counties. And it really is a county-by-county approach.
Mr. Chair, what is there a base salary that now does the state pay a base? Did I miss that?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, the state pays a base salary. There are three tiers that changed last session. About 10 counties, without me digging through, is in the top tier. They're based on population. The middle tier has a large number of counties, and then three counties, which one of the policy packages addresses, are classified as part-time and are all at a lower rate. Those are Gilliam, Sherman, and Wheeler counties, North Central counties.
Please continue.
Thank you. I'd be glad to answer more questions about the change, but this graph on number 8 shows that. Number 9 really compares DA funding, all funds, with other public safety agencies. And it's a busy graph, but the numbers that should be accurate here are the percentage of changes for each of the agencies color-coded. And as you can see, the purpose of this graph and of the next one is to show you that the DAs have received by far the smallest change of any of the public service agencies, about 14.5% compared to our partners. That's all funds. And I should point out, it does not include the county contributions to DA's offices. But if you look, there's some you should have a packet of attachments for other documents, and on there is a list of each of the DA's offices with the county contribution. Sorry to be exhaustive, but yes, to give you a picture of how the counties contribute, we asked each of the counties to tell us, each of the offices to tell us what their county contribution was. So if you look on the bottom, it's about $81 million in county money supporting DA's offices, in addition to the state funding.
Yes.
Can I assume that that includes salaries and service and supplies and some of the other amenities?
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, yes, it does. All the things it takes to run an office. If you move to the next slide, number 10, this is the general fund comparison of public service public safety agencies, which is a little bit more to the point. General fund state funding. And as you can tell, in state funding, the difference between the DA's funding percentage-wise and the other agencies is even greater. The closest agency is over 40%, and the DA's still at 14.6. And that's just to give you a picture of the historical, what's happened in the last 12 years. The next two slides, 11 and 12, really show you the DA budget in a pie form. These pies look identical in size, but one is bigger. The general fund, the governor's recommended budget is a larger recommended budget than the co-chairs, and the differences we'll get to. But it shows you the breakdown, how the proposed budgets break down. And I'll get to the packages in just a little bit. The next slide, 13. Yes, I'm sorry.
Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking at the pie charts on slides 11 and 12, one of the differences is prosecutorial assistance.
Yes.
Are you going to discuss that in a subsequent slide?
I am.
Okay, so thank you.
Chair Hughes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you.
Thank you. 13 is, again, a comparison of the co-chairs to the governor's recommended budget in public safety area in general. It lists, I think, seven of the public safety agencies, and basically the difference between the co-chairs and the governor's recommended budget. And as you can see, and this is one of the things we'd like to advocate to you, is that there be a balanced approach taken to public safety funding. And we think the governor's recommended budget had a balanced approach, and we'd like to go back to that. And we're advocating that not just for our office, but for all the public safety agencies that have been involved. We know that's a challenge in terms of where do you find the money, but we think that's better policy to take a balanced approach. I think there have been questions before about if you build up one part of the system, how does that affect everybody else? And the governor, I think, took that into consideration. So I'd be glad to answer any questions, but that's designed to show. 14 really talks about, again, historically, what has happened between the 05 and the 07, the governor's versus the co-chair's recommended budgets. It's really an illustration of the previous page in a little more graphic form, with one particular agency highlighted, obviously, and that would be the DA's. Slide 15 really talks about the fact that programs that DAs have put into effect in the last 10 or 15 years really have saved general fund money. And we're going to talk about that when we talk about early disposition and special disposition courts in one of our performance measures. But if you look on the next page on slide 16, three examples of where general fund money in indigent defense primarily, but in other costs as well, has been saved by programs that DAs put into a place in various counties, including Clackamas County, which I'm personally familiar with. In Clackamas County, the savings is a little larger than the slide shows. The slide says $400,000. It's actually over $500,000 in 4 years. And that's in indigent costs alone. The point is that programs, the DAs are cognizant of the fact that decisions we make impact the entire system. And we have been able to save money and make the system more efficient by some of the programs we've instituted. Community prosecution, drug court, mental health court, early adjudication programs, and community courts. And slide 17, we tried to make an estimation of these savings, and a conservative estimate is between $2 and $4 million, and actually there's a study out of Multnomah County that talks about some of the programs being far in excess of that.
Could you tell us a little bit about that study? Just briefly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I can tell you about that study. Unfortunately, I would like to be able to give you a copy of that study. Portland State University, at the request and paid for by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, in December of 2006, completed a study that looked at a 10-year period of the Multnomah County Drug Court. Unfortunately, that study is still in its draft form, and I couldn't get them to allow me to provide it to you. But the outcome of that study was that, in fact, the drug court in Multnomah County has saved approximately 7.9 in actual direct costs to the public safety system over the duration of that 10 years. And again, I think the thing to remember is that, in fact, we're getting better at doing these projects. And so that test period ended in 2001. Over the course of the last 5 years, we're even doing better than the test period showed. It also showed a savings of about $79 million in other defrayed costs, and there's an array of costs, including the cost of crime to our communities, actual costs, et cetera, but again, I think the bottom line of that study, and hopefully, as soon as the study is actually formally released, obviously, I suspect if Multnomah County doesn't provide it to you, and they probably will, I'll certainly do that.
Great. Thank you very much. And I would just like to also say that in my home county, Multnomah County, the DA really took a leadership role in Project Clean Slate, which worked to erase minor offenses like failure to appear, which is particularly important for people once they come up for air out of when they've been in addiction for years and years. They often have thousands and thousands of dollars in debts that the state will never collect unless they're negotiated.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, what all this really shows, I think, illustrates for you is that DAs do understand that we have a responsibility not only to enforce the law, but to try and be smart about how we do it and save money where we can. The slide 18 is really a list of our policy packages, which I'd like to discuss with you in the order 101, 102, 110, and 111. So let me begin with 101. This is something new that, quite frankly, many of us in our profession believe is long overdue. For those of you who are not familiar, the DA's Association has one person who does staff work. She actually is an employee of the Department of Justice. This is something we've lived with for a long time, but the effect has been that we have not really had a unified voice and a leader to help us as an organization. The most obvious difference I think it could make to the legislature is to have a consistent person with whom you can communicate, which, quite frankly, our president changes every year. And we have try and have a consistent approach, but we're all individuals. So this is really designed to benefit much more than just the DAs. We think it can have a profound effect upon our ability to train and our ability to communicate with each other as an organization, our ability to do some real planning long-term about where we think we should be heading. We also think that this is maybe a first step to improving our technology, which we all know the system needs, and DAs, I think, are entering a period in which we're losing some of our leadership. Scott Heiser was the leader in the DACMS system in the state, which I think 28 or 29 counties have. Scott has gone on to bigger and better things, and there is a void in our organization, which we're going to have to fill one way or the other, or the organization will move in 36 different directions. So this is really what we believe is the first step. This proposal includes not only an executive director, but also bringing the staff person from the Department of Justice over into the Oregon District Attorney's Association as a staff person.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Foote. A comment and then a question regarding this policy package. One of the reasons why I think it would be important to have this association is that I'm concerned about having 36 elected officials and trying to sort of coordinate that. I struggle with my 18 members of the Senate caucus, and so I hear what you're saying in terms of trying to coordinate that. I think it would certainly be more effective. My concern is, and the price tag is relatively modest, my concern is that as you talk about parity for the public safety system, I see the indigent defense piece as also being part of the public safety system. So if we do it for ODAA, why then would we not do it for OCLA? Because they have their own association that those guys pay for with substantially less salaries out of their more meager pockets.
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, I think that's a fair question, and I'm going to reveal my rudimentary understanding of the structure of indigent defense in the state. But I think our comparison really was more to the indigent defense system, which does have an executive director. And we really viewed OCDLA as a different entity.
Okay.
We don't have that same dual function. So if you look at the Indigent Defense Office, it does have an executive director and does do many of these functions. In a perfect world, perhaps they could be more unified too. I'm not sure they'd want that. I don't want to speak for them. But I guess that would be my best stab in any answer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just around that, I was going back to slide 9. Has PDSC, that's Public Defender Service Commission.
Yes.
Then it also has indigent defense also below that. I thought there were the two. Are we talking about two different things here, or what's...
I believe one is administrative costs and one is the actual costs of paying for the services.
Okay. On the next slide on page 10, it just has indigent defense. Does that cover both? And it has OYA changes, so I was just trying to compare all those. But it's not a big deal. Just trying to figure out what we're talking about here.
Chair Shields, Senator.
When you talk about indigent defense, you're talking about the public defender. Is that Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, but you're also talking about people who get contracts for private defense.
So it is more. I mean, there is something more than just...
Mr. Chair, there are, when you think of the Public Defense Services Commission, which is a relatively new organization by title, there are two parts. There's the trial court portion, which is the, what people, I think, have generally called indigent defense. And there's a group of state employee attorneys, which are the public defenders for the appellate process. So, but they are both now part of the Public Defense Services Court Commission.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you, Chair. Can I move to policy package on 21, the district attorney's compensation? This is really, the governor's recommended budget recommended a 3% increase in the DA salaries. We're asking you to make that change here. That's $108,000 that's reflected in this particular package. And as the slide 22...
Just a moment, John. This might be a question for Mr. Wilson. Would a kind of a cost of living adjustment normally be put in as a policy option package, or did those generally get included as part of EBL for other agencies?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, district attorneys are still state employees, but they're treated differently, sort of like the governor, judges, and some of the other elected officials. They do not get automatic salary increases for cost of living or what are essentially called merit increases. So they are, for a lack of better term, at a disadvantage in that case.
Sounds like you guys need a union.
I don't think I'll answer that one.
Senator Brown, Senator Winters.
Senator Winters first.
That means there's state legislators too.
Mr. Chair, can I just, I missed the beginning of your program, and so I'm sorry, but I'm struggling because I haven't done the indigent defense aside and knowing what the caseloads are, and having worked with a number of DAs, particularly in the termination unit in Mullen County, I have a pretty good sense of what their workload is. Do you, in terms of your county, do you run by caseload? How do you manage things out? Can you give us a sense of the number of cases your attorneys in your office are required to handle on a monthly basis or weekly basis?
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, certainly. And these are rough estimates. It really depends on
the
time of cases they're handling. For instance, a deputy handling misdemeanor cases can handle anywhere from 100 to 200 cases at any one time active in their office.
Okay.
That's pending charging through trial and sentencing. A felony property team can, the numbers are fairly close to that, between 100 and 150 at any one time. And sometimes we've had them larger. We've had them as high as 200. The felony person crimes team, these are the kind of cases that require a great deal of individual contact with victims and their families, so the numbers are smaller, anywhere from 25 to 50, I would estimate, at any one time. And these are, again, raw numbers. They can be higher. And to be honest with you, on juvenile, I have a hard time keeping track of the numbers. And I would hate to estimate, because of the nature of the juvenile system, it's such a partnership when we're involved in a case and when we're not. Sometimes we're involved in cases we actually don't charge. Sometimes we're involved in cases in a variety of ways. So okay. I hope that's helpful.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Please continue.
On slide 22, as you can see, as we discussed previously, the restructure in 2005 affected only 19 of the 36 DAs, appropriately so. We are proposing a 3% increase here. And there is another handout I wanted to...
And I see Doug's got another conversation going, but when we did the sort of the compression from 5 to the 3, the restructuring piece, do you know what the percentage of increase was for the 19 district attorneys who bumped up? I mean, what kind of percentage of increase was their pay in that last session?
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, I would not want to hazard a guess.
Doug, do you know what that would have been, or...
Let me see if that material. If I go back.
Well, we don't have to get it today. I just wanted to get a sense for it. I know we pushed that together, and that bumped several of them.
Mm-hmm.
up. And so finally, then the question might go, for those who weren't part of that, they're not getting the benefit of that addition in the last session. For those who were, they're getting, you know, some on top of a little bit last time. And I wonder if there's a fairness factor there.
Chair Shields, Representative Hannah, I am one of those people that didn't get one last time, and I don't think really is an issue of fairness from my perspective. The changes last time were really, if you look at our salaries in terms of our peers nationwide, none of them are out of line except downward. So upward movement for someone is appropriate, whether or not other people get it or not. The one I'm really familiar with is the middle group that moved up to the large, to the tier one. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there was any fairness issue being already in tier one. I didn't feel this a fairness issue. And I don't think it needs to be addressed here. Just somebody from the inside.
Yeah, no, that answers the question. Thank you.
Okay. Another handout that is here for your information is a list of the offices. I'm trying to do this at the time it's relevant. In my presentation, a list of all the offices in the country and just a general description of their budgets and their general salaries and their associations. And this has been, this is from the National District Attorneys Association. So, again, that's for your review. Hopefully the things we're talking to you about are consistent with the information in here, and we'd be glad to answer any questions. On slide 23 is a category called prosecutorial funding or prosecutorial assistance, and this is actually a new funding source. We used to have something called Deputy DA supplements, which went away in the 2003-05 session, I believe. And this is really an attempt to move back in that area and provide a support for. It's a little broader description than before, but the principle is really the same, to provide a balanced funding for prosecutors' offices between state and county. It's a first step. As you can see, it's $810,000, which is considerably less than our supplements were in 1999-01, which were almost $1.9 million. And again, it's simply an effort to provide some balanced funding.
Can I ask you a question about that, Mr. Cook? So would the distribution be similar to what you have here in your packet?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, we like to take on all these issues of funding as an organization and to develop a formula. I am confident that we would follow the same approach that we've followed in the past. It would be done, I would assume, mostly by population. That is my understanding of how it's been done in the past. It's difficult to do it by caseloads because those move up and down, and we have not traditionally taken that approach.
And one of the things that I think, to the degree that we can hit two birds with one stone, that appealed to me about this is that to the degree that this could help the counties that would be most impacted by the timber payments. Do you have any sense of how this might affect those counties, Lane County and others?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, I think this will provide some relief, but realistically, the number would have to be considerably higher to make. I'll give you an example. Back in 99-01, the statewide contribution was about $1.9 million for DDA supplements, and I think Clackamas County, if I'm remembering my numbers correctly, was about $100,000 that we received as we're the third biggest county. So you'd imagine that the counties that are suffering some of that, and we have some timber losses, but just to get to that amount, you'd have to more than double this amount. So would it really fill the hole? No. Might it help? Yes.
Thank you.
One of the advantages of prosecutorial assistance versus deputy DA supplements is it provides some flexibility at the local level to decide how to spend the money. If you look at slide 24, there are a variety of things that we could spend it on rather than just one, which really, quite frankly, would be the most advantageous for us.
Senator Winters.
Quick question. I'm sorry I was late and you may have already covered it. But what challenges in the current salary structure that you have in retaining deputies, deputy DAs?
Deputy DAs, Chair Shields, Senator Winters. Well, we're still well below the marketplace for private lawyers. I'll give you three examples. Three lawyers have come to my office in the last 3 years from firms in Portland. They took 50% pay cuts to come. The good news about that is that they came because of the work, not the money. That hasn't changed, but there has been considerable progress in our ability to at least stay in the ballpark. Salaries have increased for DAs, for deputy DAs in the last 10 or 20 years. If they hadn't, we'd be in real trouble. Brad Berry sent me an article from Canada where they're losing DAs by the slew because they can't even afford to buy houses and raise families. And that was certainly true when I was a young deputy. So it is better than it used to be. But we're really not competitive with private firms. I don't think that really should be the expectation.
So retention is not so much a major issue?
I think it's always an issue, but I do not think it's a pressing issue at the moment for my office. I can't speak for other offices, especially in the rural counties. We're gonna talk about the part-time DAs, and I really do think, and I want to talk about that perhaps right now. One of the reasons I think it's important to move the three DAs to full-time, regardless of the workload, is the quality of the people you can attract. And I really think having prosecutors of good quality is a real investment in justice. And it isn't just money that's going to draw people, but if people can't support a family in a rural environment, and you're going to have a hard time recruiting. And if you can look at some of our rural counties, there's been turnover. And one of the challenges has been people supporting themselves. We have a DA here, Marion Weatherford, from Gilliam County. And he'd be glad to talk to you about that, about the challenges of that. We have a statute. I'm getting a little ahead of the presentation, but since it's in context, there's a statute, some legislation that's moving through that would no longer allow private practice for part-time lawyers. And the lawyers who work in these part-time counties will tell you it's because it isn't practical to do it. First of all, there isn't enough business, and second of all, they're busy doing their jobs. So that, to me, is a pressing issue in terms of retention of those three part-time counties.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, while we're talking about this issue, I also think it's rather odd that you would have a DA also doing a part-time private practice. I mean, I just think there's a huge conflict there. You know, there may not be a direct financial conflict, but certainly the appearance of conflict when you're doing other cases, it's just really odd. So I hear what you're saying. I think you make that is also a really good point about this is just crazy for these guys, gals, some of them, to be doing other work on the side. It's just very awkward. It'd be like our police officers moonshining in order to make enough money to make a living. It's just
moonshining.
Moonlighting. Well, maybe they're making moonshine. I don't know. But moonlighting, yes, yes. I was looking at Representative Barker when I was thinking that.
Original.
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, thank you. And especially in small communities where everybody knows each other, your conflict problem just grows exponentially, it would seem to me.
But, Mr. Chair, it would be kind of amusing to see the same person prosecuting and defending the same person.
And was Mr. Weatherford going to testify during public testimony? Or? Okay. We would like to hear.
Thank you. Next, there's a handout that, and again, it's really more historical, the Deputy DA Supplement in 03-05, and it's really more illustrative. And this is when our total Deputy DA Supplements were $64,000. So, as you can see, the payments were very small. Moving on slide 25, the tier structure, and again, I've already talked about this, and I won't belabor the point. We are asking you to move the three part-time DAs to full-time, and the cost is $176,000 per biennium. And again, there is an attachment for you if you'd like to look at it about workload. where the joining counties were slightly larger. Again, speaking personally, I think the issue here is as much about attracting quality people as it is workload.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Where does Wheeler County fall in the tier system?
Wheeler is a part-time. Chair Shields, Senator, Representative Hanna.
But aren't Gilliam and Sherman as well?
Yes.
Okay, well, they show up on Tier 3. I don't know, maybe I'm misreading the chart. They're showing up as Tier 3, but Wheeler does not?
Representative Shields, Representative Hanna, for some reason it didn't make the handout, and it was astute of you to notice that.
So it didn't make the cut.
But it basically works the same in Wheeler. I apologize. We didn't have the stats for it.
So it is included. Tier 3.
One more example of how they feel they're not being noticed.
Mr. Cook, before we go on, I just want to make sure I understand this chart that has the DA supplements on it. This $64,365, that's a quarterly payment of some sort? Or? Okay.
Chair Shields, yes.
Thank you.
If there are any more questions about the tier structure, I'll move on. Performance measures, this has been a very interesting ongoing discussion between staff and the DAs about what can work and what can't in terms of performance measures. And I think we've made some real progress, and we have three to propose to you. They are child support collections, crime victim assistance, and early and special disposition courts. And on page, well, actually, it's after page 26, are the documents outlining the three performance measures. And they're, as they should be, they're pretty straightforward. Child support collections is a percentage of child support collected relative to the total child support owed. That is the proposal. So how good a job are we at collecting the money that's been owed? Services to victims is a percentage of the cases where the DA has provided the victim with notice of victim rights within 5 business days of the defendant's arraignment. And this is, again, something we're supposed to be doing. It's been a challenge and an ongoing effort, but it would be an appropriate performance measure. And finally, percentage of early and special disposition or early and special resolution programs is a percentage of DA's offices resolving cases through early and special resolution and the number of cases involved. And I'll give you an example that I'm personally familiar with. In Clackamas County, we have a number of programs that would fall into this category. We have a mental health court, which has been in operation for about a year and a half. We have a drug court in adult court. We have 2 drug courts in the juvenile system, one for the families and one for the offenders. We have a community court, which has been in operation for less than a year. And we also have an early disposition program in our county, which is fairly small, but has had a real impact on innocent defense. And that is for first-time offenders who commit fairly minor misdemeanor charges, such as misdemeanor shoplifting, who have no record. We offer them a violation at arraignment, which means no crime. There's no attorney involved. If they choose to take it, the judge talks to the person and make a decision. And we've saved over $500,000 in 4 years in innocent defense costs. It's very easy to calculate. You just do the number of cases you pled out times the charge per case. So there are a variety of ways that our offices are involved in these kind of programs. Mental health court, for instance, is, and I know Multnomah County has a lot of programs, but our mental health court, what we tried to do is we tried to target people with mental illness who committed what we would call more minor offenses, vandalism. And these are folks you typically will see walking on the street, confused, looking homeless, who get into trouble. And typically what would happen to them is they go to the jail, go through the booking process and the arrest process, and then get released, and then get picked up again. And so they would accumulate charges fairly quickly. They were less a threat to the community than a nuisance, and really the underlying problems were homelessness and not staying on their medication. So we designed a mental health court. The judge meets every week, People come in with their mental health worker, with their families. It's really very, it's unlike any court I've ever seen, even a drug court. It's very therapeutic. And the idea is to use the leverage of the system to convince the person
to take their meds,
live in a stable place, and get a job. And we've expanded it from 30 at one time the first year to 60 this year. And there are discussions about increasing again. So we're targeting a very specific population and trying to get smarter. And there are all sorts of impacts from that. For one thing, the police aren't all the time arresting people. They have time for other things. There's not as much damage to the community. And we aren't spending all this time in our jail with folks like this, which is really not the best place for them. We're trying to differentiate between offenders who really are more serious. We have people with mental illness who do much more serious things. They go through a separate process. These are people who haven't done that kind of thing, who we think we can leverage into doing the things they need to do to stay safe and not commit crimes. So that's an example, and we think it would be good to track those things. There used to be a requirement to do early disposition programs by statute. It was removed a few years ago. We decided it would make sense to go back to it because they really do continue to spread. Because we try and use our resources wisely.
A couple of questions, Representative Hanna, then Representative Nathanson.
And I want to back up to the child support issue. So if that's, if you need to wait a second, we can do that. But I want to ask a question on that. Are you all right with that?
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Foote, as I look at that child support collections, with eight counties not providing that service, that's 22% of your counties. So you're setting up a performance measure where 22% of the counties don't participate. And then, and maybe it's here and I don't see it, but it doesn't look like you're comparing your success rate against that of the Department of Justice. And so, just as a suggestion, it seems just a little odd to pick one that you don't have 100% of the counties participating in, and then that you're really going to compare against the remaining counties, not against the other agency that's doing the same work. So just as a suggestion, maybe you make that comparative part of the deal.
Mr. Chair, the wording of this performance measure was set up so that you could, it's the same wording and measures the same thing as the DOJ performance measure, so the comparison okay. is able to on
Good.
That particular one.
Good.
Chair Shields and Representative Hanna, I also, another way of thinking about this, and it's a good point, and I'm just thinking about your question, is that it's also good to remember that the other eight offices are being measured via DOJ
in
a different way, but the same function is getting measured. It isn't like eight counties are getting left out. It's just being done by a different office.
I think good report, and to Doug's point, if the measure is close to the same, that helps because this committee would be looking at both.
They are different populations, too, I might say, and when we do look at them, it'll be good to have a discussion about what the differences are as well as the similarities.
I don't know if you can answer this, Mr. Foote. This might be a better question, obviously, for Mr. Dugan, but you look at some of the lists of the counties that are now participating in child support and instead asking DOJ to do it, but Deschutes kind of jumps out as a big one. The small ones you can understand just intuitively why they might not want to. Have you heard any rumblings from the counties on why they've elected to not participate, or Kevin, do you want?
Well, ironically, Chair Shields, members of the committee, in 2003, I had the discussion with my commissioners about giving my function to the state because I was suffering, I was looking at some real cuts. And I had to look at the idea of, and it wasn't something I wanted to do, could I make a cut that actually didn't cut the service away from the public? The service would still be provided by somebody else. And I made the decision not to do it, and the commissioners wanted to keep it local, and we did that. But I would imagine that those are the kinds of things that drive people to those decisions, or at least to think about them. I can't speak for Deschutes County. I know Mr. Dugan is very satisfied with the service he gets there, but I think he's really the one to really talk about that other than my just that one observation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to discuss early and special disposition for a moment. Now, I know I'm getting into an area that could be technical, and I certainly don't purport to understand it fully yet. One question is just to make sure that we're really talking about the same thing. On slide 26, it's called early and special disposition, but the phrase on slide 32 is early and special resolution. I assume it means the same thing. I had a very vague recollection of making a note at the Ways and Means Road hearings. There were seven of those with an average of 61 people testifying for each session. So that's a whole bunch of things to remember. But I have a vague memory of someone stating, we tried to do early disposition and weren't allowed. And I wondered at the time what that meant.
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, members of the committee. I'd be speculating, but I'll try, because I don't know who said it. But I do know that there have been challenges at the local level, a variety of them. The one I'm most familiar with, change is always, as you know, change. People aren't always crazy about change. And so when you're to do something different, you're oftentimes going to get people who think it's a bad idea, sometimes for good reasons and sometimes because it's change. So there's that component. The other component that I can remember is that there has been concern by the defense bar about the extent of the programs and how they're run. And specifically, if you try and run programs that save a lot of innocent defense money, there's concern about whether or not folks are getting advised properly before they make decisions. And I think there have been counties in which that concern was not resolved. Now, I think that many of the counties, for instance, Washington County, and I'm trying to think. Well, I know Washington County in particular struggled with that the first few years, but they are making real progress because we all have a shared interest in this. But sometimes it takes a while for people to come around and realize that there's a shared interest. So that would be my initial thought about what you might have heard. I do think we've made a lot of progress, and one of the advantages of this measure is you'll be able to see this more clearly through reporting, where it's working, where it's not, and why.
Hello.
Thank you. So I'm going to conclude that there was either a philosophical or a sort of a policy objection, but not a legal or procedural reason why this person wasn't allowed to implement an early disposition program. Is this something that over time there will be a published set of best practices or standards that would help help alleviate the concerns where one has not been implemented yet?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, I don't know if that sort of thing, best practices, has been published, but I know there's a lot of communication amongst DA's offices. We are very oftentimes the gatekeeper have a lot of influence over how it's run because we're obviously charged with the responsibility of making the decisions about charging and negotiating. So I know there's been a lot of communication among DA's offices about what the best practices are. It is very oftentimes very much a local solution with some general principles involved, and it's difficult to draw too many straight lines about that. For instance, how they're doing in Washington County is very different than how we're doing in Clackamas County. That has a lot to do with the relationship between the defense bar and the DA's office, and that can be a very complicated subject. So I think we've really let those kind of develop on a local level while encouraging them.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Members of the committee, I'm on slide 33, and this is some legislation that we have proposed, and I want to particularly talk about House Bill 2329. This is perhaps a bill you've heard about. House Bill 2329 is a proposal that was reached with extensive discussions with the Department of Corrections, the District Attorneys, Crime Victims United. And we originally really got together because we had things to be concerned about. And what we ended up trying to do is to develop some solutions to those concerns. And they are designed to address two things, the alternative incarceration program and repeat property offenders. And they are really the same inmates in many cases. The alternative incarceration program was established in 2003 by the Department of Corrections, and the principle was to allow people who are eligible, and it could be Measure 11 because they're not eligible for time cuts, to go through a drug and alcohol program, or I think that's pretty much what it's designed for, and thereby earn time cuts in their sentence, up to 36 months. But the 36 months did not include the earn time. So it could be 36 months plus the 20%. So, for instance, you got a 50-month sentence, you could get 20% off, which would be 10, and 36. So theoretically, you could get 46 months cut off. Now, you couldn't get that much cut off because the program took anywhere from 6 months to a year. But you could get the rest of it cut off. A lot of concerns were raised about those time cuts by people in my profession and Crime Victims United in the last year or two. So we tried to address that issue. How can we tighten that up and still provide inmates an opportunity to do treatment, which, quite frankly, I think all of us think there's not enough of it available. And then on the other, repeat property offenders. And repeat property offender statutes are people who do multiple felony property crimes, and after their fourth, they start being eligible for a prison sentence. That's how long it takes to go to prison for a property offense in Oregon. So 13 to 19 months was the minimums. Some of them could get them stacked if they got a whole bunch of offenses and get more time, but the minimums were 13 and 19. So we wanted to address both those issues. We wanted more consequences for people who do repeat property offenders who are way over the four. We have the numbers show there were hundreds, with as many as 8, 10, 12 prior property offense convictions. Deal with some of those people with longer sentences who just weren't getting the message, but still retrain some of the essence of the AIP with an incentive and treatment. And that's really what 2329, it's a compromise. It's not perfect. There are things in it that DAs are not crazy about, the time cuts. There are things that others are not crazy about, the increased sentences for repeat property offenders. But we tried to blend the two concerns and to both give people an opportunity to do something about their drug treatment and receive a time cut. The time cut's limited to 24 months now plus earned time, not 36. So that's shrunk a little bit. And if they don't get it, they do longer. If they aren't willing to change their behavior, they do longer. And if they get the time cut and get out and get a new one, they don't get the time cut next time if it's within 5 years. So there are some details to it. I think
that is past judiciary and it's down in Ways and Means now, is that right?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, yes it is. And there is a price tag to it, as there is often, more in 4 years from now than two. The price tag really rolls longer because those repo longer sentences really don't change until the length gets longer. We believe this is good public policy. It addresses the public's concern more specifically about property crime and provides a balance. So we're encouraging you to consider it. We'd be glad to talk to you more about it if you'd like, about why we reached this agreement.
Would you like to ask that question directly, Senator Winters?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. What does it cost?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my understanding, and it's I didn't make the numbers, but it's my understanding it's $7 million in the next biennium and $47 million in 2009-11, I believe. And quite frankly, you know what that's a reflection of? That there's so many of these property offenders in prison. There are far more than you know.
Let's keep moving on because we got to get to public testimony at 4:10 or so.
Yes. Page 34, this really is a statute designed to provide the authority, if you were to make the changes in our budget, it would provide the mechanism to do that. 2799 is really the piece that I was talking about earlier for part-time DAs that no longer do private practice. And in conclusion, it must be 36, is really a chart again showing the history of support for DAs on the various categories. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time and your patience on this, and I'm glad to answer any questions.
Very nice job, Mr. Cook. We thank you for coming. And any other questions, we'll jump into public testimony.
Doug, in this presentation, the difference between the governor's recommended budget and the legislatively approved budget under the DA salaries is 8%. Would I assume that's the 6% increase plus the difference between part-time and full-time for the other three?
It could be, but there'd also be, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, benefit.
Is roll up there?
Well, there'd be roll up, but the DAs also get health coverage, the flexible benefit plan that all state employees do, and that would play into the increases too.
Okay.
Thank you very much. All right, now we're going to shift into public testimony. Why don't we bring up the DA from Gillon County, right? Ms. Weatherford?
Hello, I'm Marianne Weatherford. I'm the Gillon County District Attorney, and most of you were in Chairman Shields, members of the committee. Most of you were in Bend. I got my 2 minutes there. And so I'm going to cheat and try to get another 2 minutes.
That's all right. Probably half weren't there, so feel free to take your time.
Give him three, Mr. He had to drive a lot further to get here than
there. Actually, I have a trial that starts at 8:30 in the morning, too, so let me get back about midnight. But the emphasis of my testimony in Bend was that there are no longer any part-time district attorneys. And the knowledge of that fact has been lagging. We've tended to stay out there and do our job, and it's not always as easy for us to get away because we don't have somebody to cover for us. So we don't make it to as many association meetings. In past sessions of the legislature, we've been less likely to make an appearance and make our case, so we've never really made our case. So we've been out of sight, out of mind, and a perfect example would be the last biennium. 17 district attorneys, there was several tiers were shifted into one tier. There used to be at least four, maybe five tiers for salaries for district attorneys, and all those were rolled up into tier two except for the part-time district attorneys, and we weren't really at the table. And I've been a district attorney now, this is my sixth year. I was appointed by Kitzhaber in 2001, I was elected in 2002, and I was re-elected last year. And it takes a while to get some perspective as to what long-term nature of our job is. And I will say that when I first became a district attorney 6 years, I entered it under the impression that this is probably a part-time job. And I came from private practice. And within a year, I realized that was impossible. And there aren't any district attorneys in our three counties that have a part-time private practice anymore. In fact, just as a side note, the last Tier 3 DA that had a serious part-time private practice had his law license suspended for malpractice. To try to be able to coordinate those two assignments is going to compromise the integrity of the job. The governor included rolling us into Tier 2 just based on the recognition that it's getting harder to attract and retain somebody that you would consider to be a career professional in our field to our three counties. And the governor didn't base it so much on caseload, but I, in preparation for talking to the Ways and Means, I'm the one that put together those caseload numbers. And I think caseload is a weak way to look at our job because there's not a comparison. However, I was startled by the numbers. But when you look at caseloads, you can't compare everything across the board because some of those cases are 26 counts, some of those cases are one count, some of those cases are violent crimes. So, and also, for every case that's filed, there's at least one open investigation that's never filed. And so it doesn't really reflect what we do. But it was just some indication that the caseload alone indicates a full-time nature of the job. But I want to touch on something I didn't really touch on in Bend, and that is the statewide function. The reason my job is so demanding is because most of my defendants are not residents of my county. And that's not because I'm trying to single out non-residents. But most of the defendants that I have a closer connection to your communities. It might be somebody who is driving down the interstate drunk, and by me prosecuting it, they're less likely to hurt somebody in your neighborhood. It might be somebody who's burglarizing an empty farmhouse where the family's not home, and Neighborhood Watch isn't going to help in that situation. I prosecute a lot of crimes that are running under the radar in your communities. And when District Attorney Foote talks about property crimes, it's true. The property crimes in Oregon in general, you have to have quite a few of them before it's really taken seriously because of the overload in the system. But I do probably elevate them in my community. And so I deal with them, and I deal with a lot of crimes that might be considered almost precursor crimes in a larger community, where I'm dealing with the delivery of methamphetamine or possession of methamphetamine. I actually get jail time. I'm more interested in behavioral change, but sometimes that modicum of jail time is part of that, and they're not going to get it elsewhere. And that same person is more likely than not committing burglaries in your community, committing thefts in your community, and dealing drugs to young people in your community. And so, on a statewide basis, by being able to focus on certain crimes, maybe more deliberately, I'm having a statewide impact. And I know that it was talked about, you know, that 5% of our funding comes from the state, 95% from the counties. There's always this, some counties will provide supplements, some counties won't. Typically, the counties at the lower end of the pay scale are the ones less likely to provide a supplement because you've got local politics involved. You've got, you know, the local inertia that says the state should be funding this, and at the state, there's a certain mindset that's saying the county should pick up more of this. And the problem with too much reliance on county funding, particularly for the position of elected DAs, is that the more susceptible we are to funding from our county commissioners, the less independence we have. And some people, when they think of district attorneys, they think of prosecutors. Well, prosecutor is really the more technical function we have. We really are the guardian of the public trust. And we are the chief law enforcement officer in our county, and we're the ones, when there is excessive force, when there's dishonesty, when there's abuse within law, we're the ones that trigger an investigation. We're the ones that have to get to the root of it. We're the ones that have to have the professional stature to rise above local political pressure. We're accountable at a local level. But if there was some movement toward our salaries being dependent on local politics, it undermines our integrity. And I deal with it every day. And it applies also to the Oregon State Police as an example. When I have an issue, and I had one in the last year with a trooper that appeared to commit perjury on the stand, and the Oregon State Police won't tolerate it. if they see any unprofessionalism in their ranks, they set the standard for professionalism in our state. They're state employees. Now, you see that in most of your county employees, in most of your sheriff's departments, but it's not as consistent. That professionalism is not as consistent. And often, if I'm investigating the same sense of abuse, unless somebody has a local political axe to grind, I may not get the same support. But I got absolute support from the Oregon State Police. And so sometimes when there's discussion about, well, let's move more of the statewide functions to the counties, even with respect to law enforcement, that's the danger. At least have that strong statewide professional force in place, because they're setting the standard for your local employees as well. And that is the role that we have to serve as district attorney. And it's just as true out in our counties. I have to guard against our local law enforcement differentiating against local residents and non-local residents, and making sure that everybody's treated fairly. Because as district attorney, I represent the state. I don't represent the county. And it comes as odd to some people, but when I'm running for election, one of the things I say is I represent not just the victim, even though in a lot of cases they have the biggest say, but I also represent the community, the state interest, and I actually represent the defendant. I am there to see that the defendant is treated fairly. And sometimes that means not prosecuting, because the actual individual prosecution may be the most technical part of my job. So just with that, just saying that, I just wanted to highlight that, yes, we have a smaller population. The reason our caseload is more, the reason our function exceeds our population, is because of the statewide function. And I know that some things came out earlier, and so maybe some of those questions can arise again. I'd be happy to answer them.
Do you have one? Or
a comment, I guess.
Yeah, please.
It's interesting because I sat at this very table in the last session to hear the district attorney's piece, and it's interesting to hear you say today that those three counties weren't at the table, that got left out of the tier piece. So there always is more than one side of the story.
I'm paid about the level of a entry-level deputy district attorney in many counties. And you're not going to retain a career professional at that salary level.
Mr. Weatherford, I'd like to ask you two questions when I hear discussion around the third tier. One is that maybe the county should merge their prosecutorial functions, so I'd like you to respond to that. Two, the notion that maybe the cost of living is less in other counties, and that therefore you might not need the same dollars. So if you could please speak to both of those.
Sure. And when I met before the committee in Bend, Chair Shields, I had a handout, and one of the things I addressed, because it's hard to know what individuals' concerns are with respect to the committee, but cost of living, there is the perception that cost of living is less in rural counties. And I took a look at that, and the only thing that stands out as costing less is housing. Most other things cost more. Gas costs more, utility, and I live in my county. I'm a part of my county, but I commute round trip 70 miles a day. I live in one town in my county, and I commute to the county seat. 70 miles round trip. If I want to go to a cultural event or I want to get clothing, I'm going to go to Portland. I spend $12,000 a year on my automobile. That is an example of a higher cost of living. Even the perception of cost of housing is off the scale, because those statistics lag. The average house in our county that is modest and well-maintained is $150,000 to $175,000. So you're going to have a mortgage that's $700 to $1,000 a month for that house. And you might see statistics that the median price of a house in our our counties is 80,000 or 85,000. And I'll tell you, take a look at those houses, because you're talking about substandard housing. Houses without foundations, houses without repairs, possibly single wides. So sometimes the statistics don't tell the full story.
And then did you want to mention the notion that there might not be the workload in all three of these counties? And maybe
with respect, yeah, certainly. If you want the most efficient system, it could be more efficient. You could handle the workload from a caseload perspective with one elected district attorney and one full-time deputy district attorney. It opens another discussion. The philosophical discussion as to county accountability, as to travel, that would be more efficient. It would be possible to sustain that. But is it politically palatable, for one thing, to those counties? Will it provide the same level of accountability? I wouldn't argue that that wouldn't be possible and that it wouldn't be more efficient. It just changes the whole framework that we, the 36 counties that we operate under, and I'm not sure it saves that much money.
Because you'd also have to have defendants and traveling even longer distances, right?
Absolutely.
Because you can just call
Senator Nelson.
County, you're probably talking 100 miles, at least 150 miles end to end. So for three counties, you're 300 or 400 miles distance in some respects.
When you're talking about the small counties, you're not talking about geographical area, for sure.
Yeah, well, we really appreciate you driving all this way to come testify. We're going to have to move on to the
end
so we can get to it. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Chair.
One quick question that may be embarrassing for both me and Mr. Weatherford. Are you related to the Dayville Weatherfords in any stretch manner?
Yeah, it's kind of a distant relation, and so I'm not. I don't know them very well. In fact, but yeah, yeah, we are related. I suppose
Weatherford
a generation removed and
all communities
cousins in some respect. I think most Weatherfords, because it's just unusual enough names, are related somewhere.
Well, all we won't hold that against you.
Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and given the lateness of the hour, I'll be brief. I've provided you with a handout that works from the present backwards toward the past, partly because I thought it would make the point and partly because that's the way I think. But in order to avoid repeating the things that Mr. Foote has said, I'd ask that you just draw your attention to the last couple pages and work forward a couple more pages from there. But what you'll find is Oregon Session Law is 1961, and this provides a reflection of a system that was much different back then than it is today. In 1961, the state designated the salaries for each of the individual district attorneys. It also designated specific salaries for each deputy district attorney and paid the full freight. The state also picked up all the cost of prosecution witness fees back then. It wasn't even in the district attorney's budget because it was a separate issue. Going forward from there to 1967, you'll see a little bit of a change. It still paid the specific salaries of the district attorneys, but it provided line items per county for deputies and appears to have left some discretion within the offices of those district attorneys to figure out how to divide that money up among the deputies. So rather than identifying salaries for specific deputies as it did in 1961, the legislature moved to providing a line item for deputies. After that, I think you can just pick up from what Mr. Foote had to say about the downward spiral. The same thing happened with prosecution witness fees. That was always a state function up until the year 1983, at which point the state transferred that responsibility to the counties, but it picked up roughly half the estimated costs. It's just a little bit under $400,000. In 1993, the state provided funding for prosecution witness fees at $538,000. In 2001, it went to $584,000, and after that, it went to zero. And it's been there ever since. Now, I know a number of you have been on a road trip to Southern Oregon and actually represent some of the areas that were involved with that road trip. So you know what kinds of problems are being faced by the counties in the southern part of the state, and especially in the South Coast and Douglas County and Lane counties. I understand that Curry County is likely to go to a one-person office for the district attorney. Lane County currently needs 32 deputies and has 20. It has a ballot measure on the ballot for a county income tax. If that fails, Lane County is going to have a really big shortfall in revenues. Same thing with Josephine County. They will go from 9 people in their office down to 3. The reason why I say these things is to highlight for the Legislative Assembly, for the members of the subcommittee, that we need your help to help ourselves. And I would echo very strongly remarks from Mr. Foote and Senator Nelson from time to time in subcommittee that we're talking about a system here. And the system has to be balanced and it has to be adequate in order for it to function properly. And in these counties, it won't be either one of those things. And in other counties, there's a similar problem going on for other reasons as well. And so I'm here to testify in support of adequate funding for district attorneys and for their deputies. And I hope the subcommittee will help us to do that.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Snyder. I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair and keep us moving on to the next testimony, if I could. Thank you for coming. Ms. Swenson.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, as she's coming to the podium, tomorrow's hearing, as you probably know, is at 5:30 out at Amsville. There is a full committee meeting, unfortunately, at 4:45 to deal with a couple of bills. And I think it's the intent of the chair that...
Oh, it's not a floor session.
No, it's a full committee on two bills, Measure 37-related bills. And
small topic.
The intent would be to have folks hustle out to Amco, which is 8 or 9 miles out, and as soon as that's over, then start that hearing. I put a map in front of you of how to get to the school where it's being held. This is related to Head Start and its impact on public safety. And we are not providing any arrangements for rides since it's so close, but if someone needs a ride, you may want to talk to one of your colleagues.
The look of bewilderment.
45 minutes for Measure 37. What's wrong with this picture, Mr. Chair?
Well, now, is there a floor session tomorrow in the House?
I don't know. I'll have to check that.
Because what we could do is just have the non-full members begin if we had to, if you wanted to go welcome people.
Floor session's also scheduled from 4:30 to 7.
Well, I made my leadership aware that our committee will not be there, so after 5:30.
Well, question of that, what is the Measure 37 and what is the other?
They're both Measure
37. So we'll be on that one.
There are advocates on Head Start coming from all over the state, so it is real important that we all be there at 5:30 at Almsville Elementary in Representative Cameron's district. I'm going to hold off on the questions so that we can get going with Ms. Swenson's testimony.
And Senator Winters.
Yes, and Senator Winters.
Senator Winters on full ways and means. That's
oh, it's your district, too, right?
It's my district, okay. Too.
Far away, Ms. Swenson, then. We'll
thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ingrid Swenson. I'm Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. And I'm here today to express support for adequate funding for the prosecution function. As I said last week, in support of our own budget request, a well-functioning criminal justice system or juvenile dependency system requires that each component of the system do its part of the job adequately. And if a district attorney, and I use those words too, is not qualified or lacks the needed training or experience, the wrong cases may get prosecuted, the poor decisions can get made about what cases to take to trial, what cases to accept negotiated pleas for. There are obviously serious implications for the public safety system as a whole and for the cost of that system if we don't have adequately trained and compensated district attorneys. By way of example, I did have an opportunity to observe the new Washington County Early Disposition Program. Mr. Bob Herman, who was here last week and testifying, talked a little bit about how that's working. And when I was out there, I was tremendously impressed that all sides were working hard to make sure that it was a successful program. And as Mr. Herman testified last week, I think it owes its success to the fact that the people handling it on both sides are highly experienced attorneys. He assigned one of his most senior deputies to handle that special court. And as a result, the defense attorneys understand that the information and the offers that they're receiving from that district attorney are based on knowledge and understanding of the system and are probably the best offer they're going to receive in that case. In order for district attorneys to recruit and retain their attorneys, it's as important for them as it is for us that they be properly trained and that they be adequately compensated. Thanks for allowing me to comment.
Thank you, Ms. Swenson. And since we are running out of time, are your questions vital before we close? Okay. Why don't I let everybody go? So we appreciate your testimony. Nice job. And this meeting is adjourned.